Please note that the views expressed on this program are those of the individuals who speak them, and not necessarily those of Portsmouth Community Radio, its Board of Trustees, members, volunteers, or underwriters. Good evening and welcome to Spirit Radio. I am your host, Willie Hassel. Along with my co-host, Lynn Nickerson, we will take you on a journey into the unknown, where the paranormal becomes the normal, a journey to a world cloaked in darkness, where reality becomes a thin veil. So sit back, relax, and join us as we venture into the shadows, the darkness, the unknown, and back. And good evening and welcome once again to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. I am your host, Willie Hassel, your gatekeeper to the dark side, your guide to the realm of the unknown, the unseen, the unthinkable. And she is the always lovely, she is the mystical, and she is just flying into her chair. She is Lynn Nickerson.
Good evening, Willie.
How are you?
Great. Hey, did I see that little Christmas weather elf? I thought I heard her.
You know, I didn't actually see her, but I did hear a rumor that she's going to be here next week.
I thought I saw her.
You thought it?
Yeah, but she's going to be here next week?
Well, I don't know. If you saw her tonight,
do you think she'll stick? I saw her.
Think she'll stick around that long?
I don't know. Maybe she'll come back, though.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay.
I always look forward to her in that cute little elf suit.
She likes you, Willie.
Oh, she does?
Yes, she does.
That's so sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the way you say that. Yeah. Yeah, right. So, shall we get on to important business?
Absolutely. Okay. It's time.
It is probably past time. Tonight on Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, it is a pleasure once again to welcome to the show Valor Ventura. Vala is the author of a number of books on all things bizarre, from banshees to werewolves to mermaids to all sorts of strange and wonderful creatures of the night. She is a lover of all things odd, unusual, and truly freaky.
And bizarre.
And bizarre. I think I said bizarre. Yeah,
did
that
you?
Was
okay.
That was up.
I wasn't
back
listening.
There a little, you never pay attention
I
to me. I know. She's a lover of all things odd, unusual, truly freaky. And guess what her favorite holiday is?
Halloween.
Halloween.
Yes.
And I can relate to that.
Yeah, me too.
That's my favorite holiday too. So joining us tonight for her second appearance on Spirit Radio, let's welcome Vala Ventura. Welcome, Vala. Good evening.
Hi, Vala.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
It's so a nice pleasure.
Thank you for coming back.
So how have
my
you been?
Pleasure.
Since we talked to you last, how have you been?
I've been wonderful. I actually, since we last spoke, I completed a manuscript and have a book darn near close to coming out. It'll be out in April. So that's exciting.
Which one is that? Is that on the fairies?
Yeah, that's fairies, pookas, changelings, and other wild creatures of the fairy kingdom. So that's a really exciting one. And then I've actually already started working on another one. So I got to keep myself busy because it's cold here in the winter. So.
We can identify.
So remember that. We're going to have to put Vala down on the schedule for April.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Vala, what's the one that you're thinking about working on?
The one that I actually am in just, you know, the planning stages, mm-hmm. I mean, it's probably going to be, if I can pull it off, it'll be later this year. We're hoping to do it in time for Halloween.
Ah.
And that will be a book of ghosts.
That sounds excellent.
That, I've included in my first two books, the book of Bizarre and Beyond Bizarre, both have sections on hauntings and paranormal experiences, especially as told to me kind of experiences. So that is, so it'll be ghost stories, haunted places, the history of, you know, seances, Ouija boards, and probably some interesting things, which we might touch on tonight, like funeral customs and,
okay.
You know, corpse candles and fire coffins and all that kind of fun
good.
Stuff. So,
I got to say, anything to do with ghosts, so it does seem to be timeless and it always sells.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, I'm the person that will buy those books.
Me too.
I want everyone's book of ghosts. I want every, you know, I'm all the, whether it's ghost stories or, you know, haunted places or, you know, whatever town I go to. I'm sure many of your listeners can appreciate, as can both of you, that you learn so much about the history of a place.
You do.
When you learn its ghost stories.
That's
and
right.
And you go on those tours, and often the people giving those tours are so knowledgeable about the buildings they're talking about, what year they were built, who built them. And so you really get a lot of this sort of, you know, overlooked history at the same time as, you know, getting this wonderful kind of ghost story. So that's definitely one of my favorite things to do in any place I go to or in my own hometown. So
truly,
and, you know, you never can quite get all the legends. There's always someone who's willing to come forward and share their own experience. And, you know, it's sort of infinite.
Well, I think the ghost stories kind of lose value if they're not given some kind of context. You've got to have some personal, emotional, and historical context for the ghosts. To give them more value.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful.
I agree. It makes them much more compelling, and there is something about traveling and being in places while someone's telling you about, you know, the history of it. And usually, you know, if there's some sort of haunting involved, there's often a very dark element to that history.
Mm-hmm.
I recently traveled to Jamaica.
Wow.
Ooh.
And went to the Rose Hall Plantation, which is the home of
Johnny
the legendary
Cash.
White Witch. And that is a pretty brutal story. There's so many layers to it. And they did a wonderful job of the tour. You know, they had a little bit of like a scare factor, but it was nothing, you know, it wasn't too overdone or mm-hmm. over-dramatized. It was just sort of, you know, they'd have people kind of just walk across the room creepily. And they were just sort of illustrating their point to things, and plus giving people a little bit of a, you know, there's always someone in the group that's so scared the whole time that it kind of makes it more fun. And that person is not usually me. I'm usually the nerd in the front taking notes. So I love when I go on those tours, especially with people I don't know, because they're just, you know, that person who's scared the whole time just makes it so much more fun.
Was it Whitehall Plantation, was it? That was one of Johnny Cash's homes, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. In fact, he came up during the tour, and they talked about, because they were talking about the history of the home and how it was restored. And in the little gift shop there, among the, you know, baseball caps and little pamphlets about the White Witch, there was a book about Johnny Cash, and then there was a big poster of June and Johnny there. So it was like, wait, did he just say Johnny Cash? Yeah, he did. So, and yeah. I didn't realize that connection myself until I was there. And yeah, the White Witch is this kind of amazing legend and the story of this woman who basically kind of had this incredibly lustful appetite and is alleged to have killed at least three of her husbands.
Oh, jeez.
And then she herself was murdered by a slave lover that she had kind of finally double-crossed.
Oh.
And she was you know, supposed to be a very cruel woman. And
but she managed to find three husbands, huh? Being cruel all the same, she found three husbands?
Yeah, well, she was very wealthy.
Ah, okay.
And she, and, you know, she, and she was on an island.
Said the spider to the fly.
Corner them.
Yeah.
There's your secret for any of you single ladies out there. That you just need money and isolation.
While they were out there, the caches, weren't they either broken into and held hostage or something? Something happened while they were living on the island there.
You know, they didn't really get into that. And I do know that there's more to the story, and I don't really know enough about it to speak to that. But I'm certainly interested in, I mean, I took home some literature, but the literature didn't really get so much into that. It really talked more about the house, the structure, and this Annie, the woman who lived there. But I will definitely look into that, because I think that's a very compelling kind of other element to it.
I hadn't heard that.
Well, she had died like in 2007. Who went first? I can't remember if she did or he did. I think he went first.
Oh, my goodness. How did we not know that? Yeah.
She was still alive in 2007, because I remember seeing the report when I was living in Arizona, and she was talking about something about the house having been ransacked. Something happened there, I don't recall, but it's kind of reflective of there's a lot of energy going on there, and it's not all good. It's like it's a whirlwind.
Yeah, well, you know, I do know that as far as the history of that house goes, well, once Annie was killed, the slave took most of her belongings and burned them. They didn't burn the house down, but they took a good amount of her belongings and, you know, all the personal items and clothing and things like that, and burned them because they didn't want her haunting. She was just such an evil woman.
Wow.
And so they burned a lot of her things. There are a few artifacts that survive. And then the house after that sort of, it went through this succession of you know, owners and neglect, and actually was finally in the 70s, I think, it came to the attention of like this American, this wealthy American man who purchased it and then had slowly started renovating it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not who currently owns it, but it was, they even had a few photos. And if you can imagine this very large, very all stone house that, you know, is sort of raised up on the hill and overlooks the ocean. And then it's just, you know, I mean, it's Jamaica, it's tropical, things just grow. And it had just become so overgrown and so overwrought. And some of the original house they weren't even able to restore. They had to completely take it down. But one thing that she told me that was very interesting that I had never heard was that it was a calendar house. So a calendar house had, see if I can remember this right. So a calendar house has 365 windows, 52 doorways, and 12 bedrooms.
Really?
And so it was kind of a superstitious thing, although I don't believe the woman who was so evil was the original. They weren't the original owner, so it wasn't built to her specifications. It was not like the Winchester Mystery House where she had to have certain angles and things like that. But I always found the guide, when she said that, I've never heard that term before. And that's such an interesting idea that you would, I mean, that's a lot of windows
to wash,
a lot of work to build something like that and import everything, you know, into Jamaica. And then you're just there and you're imagining all these, you know, people having to like carry it all up the hill and assemble this like glorious house for, you know, people that they don't know.
Yeah.
And there's a dark but very compelling and rich history there.
Oh, I never heard of that term, calendar house.
Oh, I haven't either.
That's can't imagine.
I know, neat, right? Yeah.
365 windows. Wow. Well, anyway, I wanted to give our listening audience just a really brief history on your background to let them know exactly how you got into this. And you had mentioned before on our other broadcast that when you were a child, your mother had an interest in the paranormal, and she openly shared it with you. And as a child, the family would go for picnics in the graveyard or graveyards, which actually isn't so strange because that was a really popular thing to do in the 19th century. She also had tarot cards on hand, which were available to you, and the family talked about past life regressions, and you even had Halloween lights on your Christmas tree. So you had been exposed.
I like that
idea. Yeah, I think it's really neat, too. So you had been exposed to an expanded way of thinking as a child, and hence the final project is product is that you are the progenitor of all these quirky and wonderfully informative books. So that's how you came about that. So I was hoping tonight that we could take off where we left off on the last show, just to kind of clean up what we were talking about, which was gypsy vampires. Do you recall any of that, Varla? If you don't,
that's
fine. But okay,
yes.
Great, because we were talking about gypsies.
I'm not sure exactly where we stopped, but I know that we did sort of start touching into, like, you know, real vampires.
Yes.
And sort of the vampires among us.
Yes, we had touched on that.
Yeah, so, I mean, I personally, it's interesting because when I was working on the book about it's banshees, werewolves, and vampires, and a few other creatures we threw in there. But vampires are kind of amazing because they do have this very romantic and very, you know, we're very attached to them as a culture. We rely on this, the sort of the myth of the vampire, and we use the idea of, you know, of vampirism in a lot of our, even in our regular language, you know, we say
we
things, we call people emotional vampires. We feel drained. We find, you know, this idea that you're just exhausted and sort of, you know, like as if somebody's taken, you know, the life out of you.
Yeah, they wear you out.
So I think we have as a culture a very wide and rather accepting view of the vampire compared to maybe some of the other creatures or even, you know, something like witches. I think that more people, whether they believe in any form of paranormal or not, love vampires. Vampires are, you know, something we fantasize about. And so it was interesting to me because I do have a couple of friends, one in particular whom I worked with in a more professional capacity on his book, who is a member of a sort of semi-underground vampire community. That they refer to themselves as living vampires, and they live a vampire lifestyle. That doesn't mean they're going around, you know, sucking on each other's blood and, you know...
Or each other's neck, but they do imbibe real blood, don't they?
And you know, they have vampire balls, and they have fangs, and they have, you know, glorious sort of costumes that look the part of a, you know, sort of a... maybe a gothic vampire, a Victorian kind of sensibility. But they're actually very, religious is maybe for lack of a better word, but there are, you know, it's sort of a magical community. It's not unlike, you know, followers of Aleister Crowley or people who are in the Wiccan community or the witchcraft community or the, you know, the fairy magic community where there's, you know, whatever their deity is. In this case, it's the concept of being a vampire and what that means, and sort of accepting your empathic abilities, your sort of psychic abilities, and your kind of embracing of the lifestyle and that sort of flip side of life.
Well, what does that entail, Varla? Do they do drinking blood rituals type thing?
I mean, not to. In my experience, I've never. I'm not a vampire, so I can't speak as a professional.
Okay.
But I can say that in my experience, if there is any kind of blood play, it is a very small facet of what people are interested in, and if it were shared, it would be, you know, completely consensual, and it would be a very hygienic and very intimate experience. So
okay.
It's not just like there's a glass of blood sitting there and everyone passes it around and drinks it. You know, I think it's more used as a symbol of sort of that life force and you know, we tie in blood with water and emotions. And so there's this kind of connection. And vampires that I know, at least, are extremely emotional and extremely sensitive. So they have a lot to give, but they also need a lot you know, they find people who are like them, who, you know, there's sort of a relationship there between people who have more energy to give, donating that energy to someone who needs it. And and also just sort of enjoying each other's company in sort of that play acting kind of way, where it's like, yeah, we're going to like live this kind of glamorous lifestyle.
Okay.
It's a melding of art and magic and
a lifestyle.
And mythology all together.
Well, is there is then really a difference between contemporary vampirism and then the legendary? And aren't the Romans, the gypsies, a bit more into the legendary or not?
Well, you know, I think I think we all love Dracula, and Bram Stoker's Dracula is just, you know, sort of the quintessential vampire novel that we all think of.
Yeah.
And of course, it, you know, Vlad Dracula did not exist as Vlad Dracula, and Bram Stoker was, you know, he was a traveler and a scholar and a historian, and he was many things and an amazing writer. And he took many different kind of myths and fears and ideas behind what a vampire would be and combined them into these incredibly compelling, you know, this incredibly compelling character. Now, there is a longstanding relationship that I have read about and talked with a few sort of descendants of Roma who have said, yes, you know, it was a common practice that, you know, the gypsy would go to, you know, a land baron in Hungary, and they would say, can we camp on your land? And in exchange, they would send usually a younger female member of the group of the gypsy tribe to go and live in the castle and, you know, sort of be the donor to this land baron. And so in that way, there was kind of this, you know, this sort of vampiric relationship. Mm-hmm. In addition, you know, we have this terrifying story of Elizabeth Báthory, who bathed in the blood of virgins because she wanted to be the most beautiful woman in the world, and she thought it would make her immortal. And so there's a longstanding belief in blood as a life force and then providing immortality. So it's not, you know, she's not the only person in history that has tried to do something like this.
Yeah.
So when we think of vampires, I mean there's the sort of overarching history of belief, and then there's our kind of modern day, what we think of as a vampire. And I mean, even to this day, there's actually this this thing called the vampire facial, which I don't know if we talked about this last time.
No.
But it's actually you have your own blood taken out of your body, and then it's like it's like spun in one of those crazy cylinder things that separates the plasma from the
subterfuge type
blood,
thing.
And then you actually inject that plasma back into your face, and it's like sort of like a Botox kind of thing to like reduce wrinkles and fine lines and sort of plump your
All
face
right.
back up. And it's actually like someone patented the term vampire facial, like it was a good thing. So sorry if you're listening and you invented the vampire facial.
The only question is, though, you know, outside of the lines and the wrinkles, do you grow fangs too?
Uh-oh.
You know, probably if you are taking the risk of injecting plasma into your face, you know, fangs would probably not be out of the question. And you know what? Actually,
just
if they
a thought.
Guarantee fangs, they would probably sell more of the idea.
Well, I'm going to study up on that more before I
step. Before you try it, huh?
Yeah. Let's get into mermaids a little bit. That was really a delightful book, Among the Mermaids. Facts, Myths, Enchantments from the Sirens of the Sea. It's a nice conglomeration of factoids and myths and some wonderful creature stories, as well as some personal accounts. And I love reading about the personal accounts. So as I'm reading this, I'm thinking, well, some of this could be true, some of it might not be true, but so many people see so much of the same thing. I wanted to ask you if you could help define for us the difference between mermaid, mermen, and maybe selkies and merrows.
Oh, sure.
So,
So merrow, M-E-R-R-O-W, could be pronounced a number of ways, Mero. That's basically the Irish term for mermaids.
Oh, okay.
And it's used interchangeably. Mermaids and mermen, mer people. So when we say among the Mero, we mean, you know, this sort of the mer creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, mostly we say mermaids because we think of the female form of mermaids. We think of these enticing maidens with beautiful hair and lovely songs trying to lure sailors, to the rocks, or mm-hmm. lure a fisherman off the shores and into the water. So, but there are plenty of accounts, in fact, very, very fearsome accounts of mermen. And, unlike the female form, they're often much more sort of terrifying and
yeah.
with long fangs, and they can look very ferocious.
I wonder why that would be. Why wouldn't they have a benevolent equivalent? Why do the men have to be scary?
Yeah, why is that?
Yeah.
Well, now, Lynn, and I no offense, Willie, but how many women do you know would actually follow a man into the sea? But how many men do you know, if they saw a beautiful woman in the water, you know, the odds are they're gonna go and try and rescue her. I just think
very true.
Probably no better. Because the men are the ones that are lurking back there waiting for the mermaids to bring their catch. In fact, there's one story in the book that talks about this woman this mermaid who basically enchants this young man, and she kind of gets stuck on the rocks, and you know she can't get out, so she's calling for help, and he goes to try and help her, and she's telling him, like, you have to lift me up, you have to lift me and carry me out to the water. If I don't get home by such and such time, my husband will eat my children. And so she's completely playing on his desire to rescue her and be a hero and make sure her children are all right. And of course, so he scoops her up because he's real hesitant. He's like, I don't know about this. And so she throws this idea out and says, okay, he scoops her up. And they get into the water and she just starts sort of like really pulling heavily on his neck, like really pulling down and pulling down. And he manages to get himself away just in time before being pulled into the water, and you know she's mad, and then she swims off. So
what is the purpose, though, to overcome him, to be in control, or to capture him as a husband?
Oh, to drown him.
Oh, that's cruel.
Yeah, to drown him, of course.
Okay.
To drown him, and I think you know it's interesting because when you read a lot of the stories, the early stories about mermaids, you know, they're not all ferocious and vicious. There are a lot of stories of mermaids sort of leading sailors or fishermen back to a safe place.
Yeah.
And back to, you know, safety out of the thick fog and, you know, providing some measure of rescue. Like, they're in a storm and then the only memory they have is seeing this beautiful mermaid, and then they wake up on the shore and they're okay, or any number of things like that. There's also the idea that mermaids actually act as sort of like a psychopomp or something, kind of guiding drowning sailors to a peaceful death and, to the watery, you know, burial land under the sea. So there's kind of that idea. And then they almost give off the impression that it's not a calculated attack so much as, you know, it's not like they're just pulling things down. They're sort of more opportunists. And you
okay.
even have a lot of situations where it's as if they don't understand that you also can't breathe underwater.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, it all kind of depends on the perspective. There's a you know, a variety of different types, just as with any
right.
kind of creature. There's a lot of there's a lot of variation.
A variety of stories. Carla, we're at the we're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, I want to continue the story about the mermaids, and there are several that I'd like to bring up. One in particular, a personal account. So everybody, just sit tight, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Supernatural Magazine, one of the UK's top paranormal magazines, provides support to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience. It is the magazine's goal to bring every aspect of supernatural news and research from around the world under one roof to create a universal platform for all those interested in the supernatural. More information is available at supernaturalmagazine.com. And you are listening to Spirit Radio, the paranormal experience, on WSCA 106.1 FM. And we will be right back after this short break.
In a world of magnets and miracles, our thoughts trade constantly and without boundary. The ringing of the division bell had begun. Steps running before time took our dreams away, leaving the myriad small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay.
All right, then let's go back to the phone then tonight for tonight's guest, Varla Ventura. Welcome back, Varla.
Hi, Varla.
Thank you so much. Hello.
Okay, so we were talking about mermaids. Now, I wanted to ask you, there are a variety of sightings, and it is in your book, it is said that even Blackbeard wouldn't allow his ship to go in whatever sections were purportedly occupied by mermaids. He seemed to take it very seriously.
Yes, even the fearsome pirate was actually afraid of mermaids, and he was worried that he would lose his crew members to mermaids. So they would always steer clear of mermaid-infested waters, which very well could have been, you know, large manatee populations off the coast of Florida could have easily have been, you know, mistaken for mermaid-infested waters. But I
like that.
Loved
that.
Manatee?
No, mermaid-infested waters.
Oh,
I like that term.
Yeah. You know,
it sounds delightful, doesn't it?
It does.
It does, really.
But I don't see how you can confuse manatees with mermaids. To me, they look entirely different.
Yeah, manatees are really a kind of ugly.
If you were out at sea for, you know, months or more at a time and probably suffering from malnutrition.
And double vision.
And also have only been in the company of other
men,
rather gruff and unwashed men.
Yeah.
As soon as you saw a nice tail in the water, you might be willing to go overboard and find out what it was.
Okay. So there were other places that they had spotted mermaids, one of them being on the northern coast of Scotland around the Orkney Islands. And they believe, the Scottish, anyway, in that part of the country, that they're fallen angels. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I did also want to, I know you asked earlier about Selkies, and I wanted to
touch
on that as well and sort of the difference. But yes, you find this theme actually fairly frequently in a lot of the kind of Celtic, the Welsh, the Irish, the Scottish myths and beliefs that tie in with the fairy kingdom in general. And Merrow are actually considered part of that same, you know, fairy realm.
Mm-hmm.
That they are, you know, either from you know, entities that were, you know, these sort of like heavenly beings or elementals that came from, you know, different aspects of the earth, the air, and, you know, that they are these at their core very, very magical beings that kind of evolved over time, and that they're you know, a sighting of one is not always something to be feared, but rather something to be revered. That doesn't mean that, you know, you should go chasing them or looking for them, but to see them just as you would with many other of the creatures that you might encounter. They all sort of have a lesson to teach you. There's something that you're learning from them. So mm-hmm. I think that that kind of ties in with the idea okay. that they may be from, you know, the great beyond or, you know, angels or from the heavens in some way.
Okay.
And so just to back up for a minute, so a Selkie is a seal-like creature, mm-hmm. so, whereas a mermaid is half, basically half fish, half human, half man or woman, and most often depicted as, you know, the bottom half being the fish part, although occasionally you do find early drawings of the reverse, hmm. and which I've seen a few sort of hilarious early sketches. I mean, they're not meant to be hilarious, but they do look hilarious because it's kind of a giant fish head with legs sticking out of it. So they're generally, you know, it's a fish hybrid, whereas a Selkie is a seal, and a Selkie is basically a, you know, a shapeshifter who turns into usually a woman who can leave her, could take off her seal coat and leave it. And usually has to be concealed, and they can marry mortals. And the legend ties in with that. That coat is very important because if a man comes upon who he believes to be a Selkie and he falls in love with this woman, if he has her coat, he can hide her coat and she can stay with him. They can have children. They can live together forever. But if she ever finds a coat, or if he puts it somewhere and says, you know, whatever you do, don't look in this box, you know, that kind of,
yeah,
that kind of scenario. And there's a lot of stories like that where it's like, just don't go in that room. Don't look in this box. Of course, you know, eventually she looks in the box, sees the coat, puts it on and like
goes away,
is drawn back out to the sea and ends up leaving her whole family behind. And there are beautiful ballads that tell the stories of
yes.
Selkies. And, you know, it's a very rich, history. They are, you know, very, and I included some sections about Selkies in my book because they're very connected and very similar to mermaids and a lot of the mermaid stories.
Yeah,
and I felt that they belonged together along with a couple of other kind of aquatic creatures like that. But I'm a huge fan of the idea of the Selkie, and some of these I've heard actually. Going back to my mother used to sing a lot of these early English ballads, and there were several that involved Selkies and sort of this sad song being sung from the Selkie's point of view, saying that she can no longer hold her own child, so she just watches from the sea. And there's stories of, you know, looking mm-hmm. out and looking at like a seal into a seal's eyes and seeing this, you know, very like human-like person looking back at them.
Joan Baez sang a couple of songs about
Joan
that.
Joan Baez, exactly.
That's right.
In fact, she has one called The Selkie.
The Selkie,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, contingent on that, there are many Irish families, as you put in your book, that claim to be descended from the Merrow or from the mermaids. And you even name the names like O'Flaherty, O'Sullivan, from Kerry, and then McNamara of Clare. I mean, these people take this seriously, that they are descendants of some of these sea creatures.
Absolutely, and that also connects with banshees. That banshees were thought mm-hmm. to be connected with particular clans, of course, because there were originally, you know, I think six clans, and then they sort of all kind of people were the descendants of the, you know, the original six, and you know, were banshees inherited by the families? Are they or did they come along with, you know, the castle or the land, or do certain people just inherit those abilities to see these creatures and be connected to these creatures because
yeah.
genetically they have the predisposition toward, you know, the sort of second sight.
Yeah. There is, you've got a couple of personal accounts in your book about mermaids and mermen, and there's one about a woman and her mother who went to Bermuda. Would you like to tell us about that tale?
Yes, and I have to just say, you know, with all of my books, I always like to put sort of a call out, you know, does anybody have any stories they want to share? And like with vampires, I got a number of people from different facets and different kinds of vampire communities writing mm-hmm. in, talking to me, sharing stories with me. And I put up, you know, does anybody have any mermaid stories they'd like to share? And I really was sort of met with crickets. You know, it was like, I got nothing. So I just kept at it, you know, and I just kept researching. And I, you know, because I really wanted to include some
personal testimonies. Yeah.
I think people will believe in ghosts and they will admit to paranormal encounters. But I feel like something like a mermaid, you know, probably more people have had experiences than are really willing to share
sure.
them. You know, you don't want to be looked at as that person that's like, wait, you know, yeah, okay, there's a line between ghosts
maybe,
and like mermaids. They're not really real, right? So anyway, I did get a couple of wonderful contributions, and I was so grateful to these women for sharing their stories. And
it really
the woman
makes a difference.
In, who's in the book, who told me about this experience she had in
Bermuda.
The Bahamas was just incredible. So basically, she, you know, the story is very similar to sort of a ghost encounter that someone might have in the middle of the night. She was staying in this beautiful cabana, you know, near the sea. She was staying with her mom, and they, you know, she sort of woke up in the night. She thought she heard something. She woke up in the night, and she saw this man, this creature standing in her room, and he looked to be, you know, a man from the waist up. And I couldn't include it in the book, but she did actually send me an illustration.
Wow.
Of what it looked like. And then I tried my best to describe it, but without, you know, changing her words too
mm-hmm.
much. So I wanted to kind of really give that picture. So it was basically the drawing was like a man, from the waist up, very muscular, very well built. Red hair, extremely, you know, sort of like short and spiky-ish red hair. I can't remember if he had funny ears or not. I want to kind of say that maybe the ears were a little pointed. There was something about it. And he had these sort of glowing red eyes and was just sort of standing in her room kind of near the foot of the bed. And she just kind of just paralyzed, you know, just, what is this in my room? Sort of staring at it, you know, doing the whole like rub your eyes thing. Like, what is this? And then, you know, she sort of like convinced herself to like look away and then, you know, was gone and she sort of fell back asleep. And the next day she didn't really say anything to her mother, but they noticed that there was this sort of puddle of water in their room. And
that's
finally
amazing.
They got to talking and the mother had not seen anything, but she had had a very, you know, kind of had been startled awake around the same time and it had sort of a strange feeling. And when she kind of shared the story with her mom, they both admitted that they, you know, thought something was kind of
strange.
You know, something was kind of amiss. And so that was, you know, that was exactly the story that she told me. And it was probably the only time I've ever heard someone give so very much detail about an encounter like that. And it reminded me a little bit of the kind of stories you hear when people, you know, they're describing like an alien abduction or, you know, like to have this sketch, like, this is what I saw. I don't know how it's possible, but this is what I saw. It's just amazing.
She said he smiled and he had sharp teeth.
Yeah, so he definitely had this. And, you know, the funny thing is that when you look at the, you know, some of the early Irish descriptions, as I was saying, that the male, the Murrow, looked very ferocious and often had like sharp teeth
yeah.
and funny noses and maybe looked dog-like or pig-like and were definitely, you know, less inviting, but of course totally ripped because, you know, they're out there swimming all the time.
Well, she ended her story with, I would highly recommend a trip to Bermuda just in case there is a chance of seeing one of these beings, whether they are physically solid like us or something in between worlds. And I thought that was very well put because, you know, what is a ghost? What is a Selkie? What is like an upright canid? They seem to be interdimensional. Sometimes they appear solid and then they seem to just fade away.
And it's, you know, really now, and this isn't true, of course, of the, you know, your fans and your listeners, because they obviously have an interest in the paranormal and the other realm. But still, there's such a stigma with, you know, seeing these things. And today we think of people as crazy or unbalanced when they talk about these sorts of things. And once upon a time, that was actually thought of as quite a gift. And still is, of course, in some places. But, it, you know, that this was a gift and that the fact that this woman was able to see this being must have been such a gift to her as well. And like, I mean, not that the second sight, the ability to actually see or feel or sense these entities, whether they're ghosts or banshees or fairies or, you know, mermaids, that is a real gift and a talent that people often are ashamed of and don't like to talk about and are worried that people are going to think they're crazy because they see or hear things. And it's such a shame to me. It always breaks my heart when I hear people kind of, you know, almost shame when they're telling their story.
I know it.
You know, and relief that someone doesn't
making fun of them,
believes them.
You know, when I was doing some research on your stuff, I came across a book. It was about Edgar Cayce. It was written by John Van Auken, and it's called Angels, Fairies, Demons, and the Elementals. Well, he talks about Edgar Cayce, and Edgar Cayce saw many fairies and sprites and whatnot. Now, that's kind of, that amazes me. I didn't know I knew that he was certainly psychic and went into trances. So that kind of lends it a lot of credibility to me.
Yes, and I think, you know, he probably didn't widely publicize that.
No, I don't think he did.
Because, you know, I mean, like I said, most people are, you know, even if they are willing to talk about their paranormal encounters, you know, they may not quite understand themselves what they're seeing.
Yeah.
Or perhaps they understand it enough to know that talking about it in the wrong circles just, it's almost dishonoring it in a way, you know, because you don't need
not
to really tell people that you need to feel comfortable to share that and have people understand what an amazing experience that is. And you need, you know, appreciation and reverence and awe for that. Rather than, you know, I mean, if I met someone tomorrow that told me about their, you know, sitting in their garden and seeing fairies, I would just like probably burst into tears of joy to know that somebody had more recently had an experience like that.
So. I mean, there are a lot of fairy tales out there, but there are a lot of stories that you've got to listen to and do a lot of comparative research and go with your own gut feeling. We haven't got too many, well, maybe, what, 7 minutes left, Willie?
Just about.
So I wanted to offer to you either we could get into whatever we have time for, but we could touch on the fairy elms and gnomes, little gnomes world, or we could get into the some of the funeral rites and the candle coffins that you want to talk about, coffin candles.
Oh, well, you know, we can, now that's something that, you know, I can go in any direction. I think because of the time of the year, I wouldn't mind telling a couple of sort of holiday themed
speakers,
if no one minds.
Oh,
that.
Yeah, that's great. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Scandinavian Christmas troll is one of my favorites. and I actually was just today at a Finnish Christmas celebration.
And
the Finns call him... Oh, now
Scrampus?
I've forgotten it. It's not Tom... so I think it's the Swedish call him Tomten, Tantu, I think, and he's a little elf, a little tiny little elf with a very pointy red cap. And now they have also Santa Claus, you know, but they have this other little elf that comes around and you leave him a little offering. And you can even buy a little Tomten for your home. And it's usually just only 3 or 4 inches high, you know, a little bigger than a Smurf, and with a nice tall pointy red cap. Very, very Santa-like, and you can put them anywhere in your house, and the thing is you have to give them a bowl of fresh porridge. And this is a recurring theme with fairies, and take heed. Do not leave fairies leftovers. Do not leave them a little bit of something that you had left that you thought, oh, I'll just put this on a small plate. They need the finest food. It doesn't have to be in great quantity, but do not compromise on quality with the fairies because they
don't—they
can tell and they don't appreciate it and they will extract revenge.
Oh,
and that
dear.
Can be stealing things from you, but they can create quite a bit of havoc in your home. So if you're going to go to the trouble to make the offering, make sure that you are doing some top quality stuff there.
Well,
so the Tomten is sort of the Scandinavian troll, and it's the idea that there's like this other little creature that you can leave offerings to. And then the Scandinavian trolls actually believed there are many, many stories. In fact, Dickens talks about quite a bit about the magic of the 12th night of Christmas, and that this is a night which is, you know, there's the 12 days of Christmas leading up, and then on the 12th night, this is actually a night when animals can talk, wow. when wells can run with either blood or wine, when many, many things can be afoot. It's a very magical evening. And so, of course, we know this magic as this incredible man who flies through the air and can bring us presents and, you know, come down chimneys and through, you know, locked doors. And so
okay.
this kind of like Christmas magic has a longstanding tradition around this time of year, this the sort of light and magic of winter and winter solstice. So it can be, and then there's also this idea that the Scandinavian trolls are out there wandering around and that, you know, the witches like to go out and cavort and dance with the trolls at midnight. And so you should really not be out too late on Christmas Eve because you may encounter some things that you can't unsee.
The 12th night of Christmas, is that actually Christmas Eve or what day is that?
Well, I think it's sort of Christmas Eve and it's the midnight of Christmas Eve going
okay.
into Christmas Day. And there's a wonderful Dickens collection. He used to put out, of course, we have many associations with Charles Dickens and Christmas,
uh-huh.
but he used to put out this pamphlet called All Year Round. And he always did a Christmas edition. And in one in particular, and I'll get into this in my my book with more about ghosts and paranormal because I love this aspect of Charles Dickens. And that is the what they did is it was on the 12th night and he kind of created this situation where there was a haunted house and it was this empty house. And each house, you know, it was an old house that had a bell associated with each room so that, you know, the lord and lady of the house could ring this bell and it would, you know, call the servants. And what Charles Dickens did is he took some of his favorite writers that he worked with, Hedda Stretton, Wilkie Collins, and others, and he assigned them each a room. And then he wrote the introduction about him and his friends going to this house and, you know, spending a night in this haunted house on the 12th night of Christmas. And then he assigned, you know, Hedda Stretton did the ghost in the clock room. And so there's this entire collection of stories that are it's kind of, you know, like this mystery and kind of got a clue-like. But it's also this great literary thing that he did with this idea of Christmas and haunted houses. And it's really a wonderful collection.
Oh, I'll have to look into that. I hadn't known that. Well, we're just about at the end of the hour, Varla. I hate to put a stop to it. You've been a delight. Thank you so much. Well, I was just going to say, any websites you'd like to mention?
Go ahead. Give out your website. Tell people where they can buy the books.
Yeah, great. Okay, so you can visit me at varlaventura.net, and I have links to all of my books there. You can find my books anywhere books are sold. You can go to Amazon, IndieBound, BNN, any of your local booksellers should be able to get it. They're all in print. And my newest book on fairies, that will be out April 1st, and I've heard if you pre-order it, you actually might get it a little earlier than that. I can't guarantee that, but that has happened in the past with my other books, so that's always appreciated, and I always welcome anyone reaching out to me. You can find me, you know, through my blog or on Facebook, and I am looking for people who would like to share their paranormal encounters with me, potentially for my next book. So
excellent.
If anyone would like to write to me, you can just, it's my name at Gmail is my account.
Varla Ventura at Gmail.
All right. Okay,
all right.
Varla, thank you very much.
And we'll have to get you back for April 1st.
Yeah, April.
For your, the fairies.
That's great.
We'll put it in the calendar, April.
Fairies. Yeah, we'll get
well,
a hold of you.
Thank you very much. You're a lovely host, and I really appreciate you having me back again.
It's a pleasure, Varla. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us. And have a good night, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, yes, and Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. All right. I guess that would be the end of Spirit Radio for another week. And I know Craig Mosher with the Graveyard Shift is coming right up.
That's right. And everyone, thank you for listening, and have a good evening.
In this one of many possible worlds, all for the best, or some bizarre test. It is what it is, and whatever. Time is still the infinite jest. The arrow flies when you dream. The hours tick away, the cells tick away. The watchmaker keeps to his schemes. The hours tick away, they tick away. The measure of a life is a measure of love and respect. So hard to earn.